Warwick strode out to kneel where the sticks had landed. Leet hurried to see. His friend wouldn't cheat, which was anathema to Freeman. But he didn't trust Warwick's watering eyes, which stung from the blowing dust. His tally stick stood at an angle, revealing the mark of 9. "You have won." Warwick turned to him. "You must get inside the shelter, my friend. We have no time to delay, no time to argue." Leet blinked moisture from his irritated eyes and shuddered. His knees felt weak, ready to collapse in despair. "This can't be. I refuse to accept it." "You have no choice." Warwick gave him a push toward the rock. "These are the vagaries of nature. You've heard your father talk about it often enough. The environment has its hazards, and you and I, we have been unfortunate this day." "I cannot do this," Leet moaned, digging in his boot heels. But Warwick shoved him violently, knocking him backward onto the rock. "Go! Don't make me die for nothing!" Shaking, Leet moved trance-like toward the crack in the rock. "Come in here with me. Together we can share the shelter. We'll squeeze in." "Not enough room. Look with your own eyes." The storm's howling rose to a crescendo. Dust and sand pelted them like bullets. The two shouted at each other, though they stood only a few steps apart. "You must take care of Farula," Warwick said. "If you argue with me and die out here too, who will watch over her? And my son?" Knowing he was defeated, knowing there was nothing else he could do, Leet embraced his friend. Then Warwick pushed him down into the crack. Leet squirmed and struggled, trying to squeeze deeper, hoping there might be enough space for Warwick to have partial shelter at least. "Take my cloak. Cover yourself. It might protect you." "Keep it, Leet. Even you will have a hard time surviving this." Warwick gazed down at him, his cloak and still suit whipped about from the angry wind. "Think of it this way. I shall be a sacrifice to Shai-Hulud. My life will perhaps gain a bit of kindness for you." Leet found himself crushed against the rocks, barely able to move. He could smell the atmospheric electricity from the sand tempest, saw it crackling in the oncoming dust wall. This was the greatest violence that Dune could hurl at them, far worse than anything found on Seleucus Secundus, or anywhere else in the universe. Leet reached up, extending his hand. Without a word, Warwick grasped it. Already Leet could feel the harsh abrasives against his skin. The wind tore at him like tiny teeth. He wanted to pull Warwick closer, to give him at least a partial shelter in the crack. But his friend refused. He had already made up his mind that he had no chance. The gale blew louder, with hissing, shrieking claws. Leet could not keep his eyes open, and tried to shrink farther into the unyielding rock. In a huge burst of the storm, Warwick's hand was torn from his. Leet tried to surge up, to grab him and pull him back, but the rock held him pinned and the wind slammed him down. He could see nothing except the roiling Coriolis forces. Dust blinded him. Warwick's scream could not even be heard over the gale. After hours of enduring hell itself, Leet emerged. His body was covered with powdery dust, his eyes red and barely able to see, his clothes torn from the rocks and the probing fingers of wind. His forehead burned. He felt sick, sobbed in despair. Around him the desert looked clear and pristine, renewed. Leet kicked out with his Temag boots, wanting to destroy all of it in his anger and grief. But then he turned. Impossibly, he saw the dark figure of a man, a silhouette standing high on a sand dune, a tattered cloak blowing about him. His stillsuit showed gaps where it had been mangled. Leet froze, wondering if his eyes had deceived him. A mirage? Or had the ghost of his friend returned to haunt him? No, this truly was a man, a living being turned away from him. "Warwick!" Gasping, crying out, Leet staggered across the powdery sand, leaving deep footprints. He climbed, laughing and crying at the same time, unable to believe his eyes. "Warwick! The other freeman stood unmoving. He did not rush to greet his friend, and simply faced away, staring northward toward home. Leet could not imagine how Warwick had survived. The Coriolis storm destroyed anything in its path, but somehow this man remained standing. Leet cried out again and stumbled to the top of the dune. He regained his balance and rushed to his friend, grasping his arm.
"Warwick, you're alive!"
Warwick turned slowly to face him. The wind and sand had torn away half of his flesh. Warwick's face was scoured off in patches, his cheeks gone to expose long teeth. His eyelids were stripped, leaving a round, blind stare, unblinking in the sunlight. The backs of Warwick's hands revealed exposed bone, and the sinews in his throat moved up and down like pulleys and ropes as he worked his jaw and spoke in a monstrous, garbled voice.
"I have survived, and I have seen. But perhaps it would have been better if I had simply died."
If a man can accept his sin, he can live with it. If a man cannot accept personal sin, he suffers unbearable consequences. Meditations from Bifrost Erie, Buddhist-Islamic text. In the months after the kidnapping of his infant son, Abelard Harkonnen drove himself nearly mad. A broken man, he cut himself off from his world once again. All the servants were dismissed. He and his wife loaded a single ornithopter with only their most important possessions. Then they burned the main lodge to the ground, reducing all of its memories to embers and smoke. The walls, roof, and support beams blazed brightly. The framework roared and crackled like a funeral pyre into the murky skies of Lankaville. The large wooden building had been Abelard and Emmy's home for decades, their place of happiness and warm recollections. But they left without once looking back. He and Emmy flew across the mountains until they sat down in one of the silent mountain cities, a place named Veritas, meaning truth. Resembling a fortress, the Buddhist-Islamic community had been built under a sheltering granite overhang, a shelf of rock that jutted out from the main mountain mass. Over the centuries, monks had deepened the hollow, digging a warren of tunnels and private cells where devoted followers could sit and think. Abelard Harkonnen had a good deal to ponder, and the monks accepted him without question. While not devoutly religious, nor even following the forms of Buddhist-Islam, Abelard and Emmy spent much time together in silence. They gave one another solace after all the pain and grief. They sought to understand why the universe insisted on striking out at them, but neither of them could find an answer. Abelard believed he had a good heart, that he was fundamentally a good person. He tried to do everything right. Yet, somehow, he found himself in a pit of demons. One day, he sat in his stone-walled chamber, where the light was dim and flickering, shed by burning candle-pots that sent perfumed smoke into the air. Auxiliary thermal heaters hidden in the rock niches warmed the air. He huddled in loose, plain garments, not in prayer, but deep in contemplation. Kneeling beside him, Emmy stroked the sleeve of his tunic. She had been writing poetry, the structured verse found in the Buddhist-Islamic sutras, but the words and metaphors were so sharp and painful that Abelard could not read them without feeling the sting of tears. She set her parchment and calligraphy pens aside, leaving the stanza unfinished. Now both stared into the flickering candles. Somewhere in the halls of Veritas, monks were singing, and the vibrations of their chants traveled through the stone. The muffled sounds became hypnotic tones without distinction. Abelard thought of his father, a man who had looked much like him, with long hair, a muscular neck, and a lean body. Baron Dmitri Harkonnen had always worn loose-fitting clothes to make himself appear more imposing than he really was. He'd been a hard man, willing to face difficult decisions in order to advance his family fortunes. Each day was an effort to increase the wealth of House Harkonnen, to raise his family's standing in the Landsraad. Receiving the Siridhar fief of Arrakis had elevated the stature of the Harkonnen name among the noble families. Over the millennia since the Battle of Corin, the Harkonnen bloodline had earned a well-deserved reputation for cruelty. But Dmitri had been less harsh than most of his predecessors. His second wife, Daphne, had softened him a great deal. In later years, Dmitri became a changed man, laughing exuberantly, showing his love for his new wife, and spending time with his youngest son, Abelard. He even cared for severely retarded Maratin, when earlier generations of Harkonnens would have simply slain the infant under the guise of mercy. Unfortunately, the more affectionate Dmitri became, the harsher his eldest son Vladimir grew, as if in reaction. Vladimir's mother, Victoria, had done her best to instill a power lust in her son. "We are so different." Meditating in the stone chamber, focused on the subtle shifting colors of candle flames, Abelard did not regret failing to follow in his half-brother's footsteps. He had neither the heart nor the stomach for the deeds that so delighted the Baron. As he listened to the distant vibrations of the monk's music, Abelard considered his family tree. He'd never understood why his father had christened him Abelard, a name fraught with scorn and infamy since the aftermath of the Butlerian Jihad. The original Abelard Harkonnen had been banished for cowardice after the Battle of Corin, forever disgraced. It had been the final victory of humans against the thinking machines. At their last stand on the legend-shrouded bridge of Hrethgir, Abelard's long-dead namesake had done something to bring down censure from all the victorious parties. It had created the original rift between Harkonnen and Atreides, a blood feud that had lasted for millennia. But details were sketchy, and proof non-existent. What did my father know? What did that other Abelard really do at the Battle of Corin? What decision did he make at the bridge? Perhaps Dmitri had not considered it a matter of shame. Perhaps the victorious Atreides had merely rewritten history, changed the story after so many centuries in order to blacken the Harkonnen reputation. Since the Great Revolt, myths had collected like barnacles on history, obscuring the truth. With a shudder, Abelard drew a deep breath, smelling the candlepot incense inside their tiny room. Sensing her husband's uneasiness, Emmy stroked the back of his neck. She gave him a bittersweet smile. "It will take some time," she said, "but I think in this holy place we may find some small measure of peace." Abelard nodded and swallowed hard. He clasped Emmy's hand and brought it to his lips, kissing the weathered skin of her knuckles. "I may have been stripped of my wealth and power, dearest. I may have lost both of my sons, but I still have you. And you are worth more than all the treasures in the Imperium." He closed his pale blue eyes. "I just wish we could do something to make amends to Lankavile, to all these people who have suffered so much simply because of who I am." In anguish he pressed his lips together, and his eyes shimmered with a thin sheen of tears that could not block the images. Glossu Raban covered with whale blood and blinking in the spotlight at the end of the dock. Bifrost Eerie, devastated by Raban's troops. The disbelieving expression on Onir Rautha Raban's face just before the guards flung him off the cliff. "Even the poor fish, mistress." Abelard remembered the smell of her burned flesh, the crash of the overturned bucket, water spilled on the hardwood floor, soaked up by the apron of the dead woman as she sprawled in it, the baby crying. Had it been so long ago that life had been good and peaceful? How many years had it been since he'd gone on a friendly whale hunt with the native fishermen, when they had hunted down an albino whale? With a start, he recalled the artificial iceberg, the illicit and enormous spice stockpile hidden in the Arctic waters. A Harkonnen treasure hoard greater than any wealth these people could imagine. That stockpile had been placed right under Abelard's nose, no doubt by his own half-brother. Now, in the stone-walled room, he stood up quickly and smiled. Abelard could not suppress his sheer delight. He looked over at his wife, who couldn't comprehend his excitement. "I know what we can do, Emmy." He clapped his hands, thrilled at the prospect. At last he had found a way to make reparations to the hard-working people, whom his own family had so terribly wronged. Aboard a cargo-carrying ice cutter that had filed no trip plan and transmitted no locator signal, Abelard led a group of Buddhist-Islamic monks, a whale fur crew, and his former household servants on an expedition. They cruised through the ice-clogged waters, listening to chunks grind against each other like mortar stones. A night mist of suspended ice crystals drifted across the waters, diffusing the boat's searchlights as the craft forged ahead, seeking the anchorage of the artificial iceberg. Using sounding apparatus and scanners, they searched the waters, mapping out the floating mounds. Once they knew what they were looking for, tracking down the imposter became simple enough. In the hours before dawn, the craft tied up against the polymer sculpture that looked so much like crystalline ice. The awestruck workers, whalers, and monks crept like trespassers into the corridors that extended beneath the water. Inside, untouched for years, sat container after container of the precious spice melange, covertly removed from Arrakis and hidden here. An emperor's ransom. Early in his long reign, Elrud IX had established severe restrictions against illegal stockpiles such as this. If the cache were ever discovered, the Baron would be punished, with an immense fine levied and perhaps the loss of his Choam directorship, or forfeiture of the quasi-fief of Arrakis itself. For a few moments of desperate hope, Abelard had considered blackmailing his half-brother, demanding the return of his baby boy under threat of revealing the illegal spice stockpile. No longer a Harkonnen, Abelard had nothing to lose. But he knew that wouldn't work in the long run. No, this was the only way to bring some sort of closure, to salvage some good from a nightmare. Using suspensor pallets and a fire brigade line, the furtive crew spent hours loading their cargo ship with melange, all the way to the top decks. Though disgraced, Abelard still retained his title as sub-district governor. He would send feelers out to his former contacts. He would find smugglers and merchants to help him dispose of this stockpile. It would take months, but Abelard intended to liquidate it for hard salaries, which he would distribute as he saw fit, to benefit his people. He and Emmy had considered, but discarded, the idea of spending heavily on a military defense system for Lankaville. Even with all of this spice, they realized, they could not hope to build anything to oppose the combined might of House Harkonnen. No, they had a better idea in mind. While sitting alone in the warm closeness of their monastic cell, he and Emmy had developed an elaborate plan. It would be a monumental task to distribute such enormous wealth, but Abelard had his trusted assistants and knew he would succeed. The spice money would be sent through cities and villages, dispersed to hundreds of mountain strongholds and fishing towns. The people would rebuild their Buddhist-Islamic temples. They would upgrade old whale fur processing equipment, widen streets and docks. Every native fisherman would receive a new boat. The money would be doled out in thousands of small pieces, and it would be completely unrecoverable. The spice stockpile would increase the standard of living for the poor people of this planet, his citizens, giving them comforts they'd never imagined possible in their hard lives. Even when the Baron discovered what his half-brother had done, he could never reclaim the ill-gotten fortune. It would be like trying to recapture the sea with an eyedropper. As the ice cutter raced back to the rocky fjord villages, Abelard stood at the bow, smiling into the frigid mist and shivering with anticipation. He knew how much good he would do with this night's effort. For the first time in years, Abelard Harkonnen felt deeply proud. The capacity to learn is a gift. The ability to learn is a skill. The willingness to learn is a choice. Rebecca of Ginaz. Today, the Swordmaster trainees would live or die based on what they had learned. Standing beside an assortment of weapons, the legendary Mord Kerr conferred in low tones with junior training master Jay Wu. The testing field was damp and slick from a light rain earlier that morning. The clouds still hadn't drifted away. "Soon I will be a swordmaster, both in body and mind," Duncan thought. Those who passed, survived, this phase, would still face an intense battery of oral examinations covering the history and philosophy of the fighting disciplines they had been studying. Then the victors would return to the main administration island, view the sacred remains of Jewel Noret, and go back home as swordmasters. "A tiger on one arm and a dragon on the other," Mord Kerr called out. His silvery hair had grown a full 10 centimeters since Duncan had last seen him on the barren volcanic island. "Great warriors find a way to overcome any obstacle. Only a truly great warrior can survive the corridor of death." Of the original 150 trainees in the class, only 51 remained, and each failure taught Duncan a lesson. Now he and He Resser, arguably the top students, stood side by side, as they had for years. Corridor of death? The tip of Resser's left ear had been cut off in a knife-fighting exercise. Since he thought the scar made him look like a battle-hardened veteran, the redhead had decided never to undergo any cosmetic surgery to repair the damage. "Just hyperbole," Duncan said. "You think so?" Taking a deep, calm breath, Duncan focused on the comforting presence of the old Duke's sword in his hand. The pommel's inlaid rope pattern gleamed in sunlight, a proud blade. He vowed to be worthy of it, and was glad to carry the sword now. "After 8 years, it's too late to quit," he said. Enclosed by a shield fence, the outdoor training course was hidden from the gathered trainees. To survive the obstacles and reach the end of the course, they would have to react to assassin mechs, solido hollow illusions, booby traps, and more. This would be their final physical test. "Come forward and choose your weapons," Jay Wu called. Duncan buckled 2 short knives to his belt, along with the old Duke's sword. He hefted a heavy mace, but exchanged it for a long battle lance. Jay Wu tossed his dark dreadlocks and stepped forward. Though his voice was hard, it held a hint of compassion. "Some of you might consider this final test cruel, worse than any real combat situation could possibly be. But fighting men must be tempered in a fiery forge of true dangers." While he waited, Duncan thought of Glossu Raban, who had showed no mercy hunting human prey on Gedi Prime. Real monsters like the Harkonnens could devise sadistic exercises far worse than anything Jay Wu might imagine. He took a deep breath, tried to stop the self-defeating flow of fear, and instead visualized himself surviving the ordeal. "When Ginaz delivers a swordmaster to a noble house," old Mord Kerr continued, "that family depends on him with their lives, their safety, their fortunes. Since you bear this responsibility, no test can be too difficult. Some of you will die today. Do not doubt it. Our obligation is to release only the best fighters in the Imperium. There can be no turning back. The gates opened. Attendants boomed out names, one at a time, from a list. And several of the trainees stepped through, disappearing behind the solid front barricade. Resser was among the first to be called. "Good luck," Resser said. He and Duncan clasped in the half-handshake of the Imperium, and then he was summoned. Without looking back, the redhead slipped through the ominous doorway. 8 years of rigorous training culminated in this moment. Duncan waited behind other toughened students, some oily with nervous sweat, some blustering with bravado. More trainees passed through the gate. His stomach knotted with anticipation. "Duncan, Idaho!" one of the attendants finally thundered. Through the opening, Duncan could see the previous student evading weapons that came at him from all directions. The young man whirled, dodged, stutter-stepped, then disappeared from view among the obstacles and mechs.
"Come on, come on, it's easy," the heavyset attendant growled. "We've already had a couple of survivors today."
Duncan uttered a silent prayer and ran forward into the unknown. The gate slammed shut behind him with an ominous clank. Focused on what he was doing, letting his mind settle into a fugue state of instant reaction, he heard a blur of voices filling his mind. Paulus Atreides telling him he could accomplish anything he set his mind to. Duke Leto counseling him to take the high ground, the moral course, never to forget compassion. Thufir Hawat telling him to watch all points in a full hemispherical perimeter around his body. Two mechs loomed on either side of the corridor, metal monsters with glittering sensor eyes that followed his every movement. Duncan began to dash past, then stopped, made a feint, dove and tumbled by. Watch all points. Whirling, Duncan swung backward with his lance, heard it strike edged metal, deflecting one of the mech's weapons, a thrown spear. Perfect perimeter. Warily he danced forward on the balls of his feet, maintaining balance, ready to dart in any direction. The words of his school instructors came to him. Shaggy-haired Mord Kerr, iguana-faced Jay Wu, enormously fat Rivi Denari, pompous Whitmore Blood, even stern Jamo Reed, keeper of the prison island. His Tai Chi instructor had been an attractive young woman, her body so flexible that it appeared to be composed entirely of sinew. Her soft voice had a hard edge. "Expect the unexpected." Simple words, but profound. The fighting machines contained mechanisms triggered by eye sensors that followed his rapid, cautious movements. But in compliance with Butlerian strictures, the mechs could not think like him. Duncan rammed the metal butt of his lance into one mech, then whirled and did the same to the other. He spun away in a gymnastics maneuver, barely eluding impaler knives that stabbed at him. As he crept along, he studied the wooden path under his bare feet, looking for pressure pads. Blood spattered the floorboards. Off to the side of the course, he saw part of a mangled body. He did not take time to identify it. Farther ahead, he blinded mechs with thrown knives that shattered their glassy eyes. Some he toppled with powerful kicks. Four were only hollow projections, which he detected by noticing subtle differences in light and reflection, a trick Thufir Hawat had taught him. One of the island instructors had been a mere boy with a baby face and a killer's instincts, a ninja warrior who taught stealth methods of assassination and sabotage, the supreme skill of melting into the slightest shadows and striking in absolute silence. "Sometimes the most traumatic statement can be made with an unseen touch," the ninja had said. Synthesizing 8 years of training, Duncan drew parallels between the various disciplines, similarities of method, and differences. Some techniques were clearly useful for what he faced at that moment, and his mind raced to sort them out, selecting appropriate methods for each challenge. Darting past the last of the deadly mechs, his heart pounded against the inside of his chest, Duncan scrambled down the slope to the rugged shore, following course markers, still bounded by the shield fence. Glowing red suspensors directed him over a frothy blue-white pool of geysers and volcanic hot springs. But waves from the aquamarine sea lapped over the rim of the rocky bowl, cooling the temperature to just below scalding. Duncan dove in and stroked down to underwater lava tubes bubbling with mineral water. Already desperate for air, he swam through the heated water until he emerged in another steaming hot spring where fierce-looking mechs plunged in to attack him. Duncan fought like a wild animal, until he realized that his mission was to get through this corridor of death, not to subdue all opponents. He blocked kicks, drove mechs back, and broke free to dash along the trail, toward the jungle highlands and the next phase. Across a deep chasm hung a narrow rope bridge, a difficult challenge of balance, and Duncan knew it would get worse. In the middle of the span, solido-projected hollow beasts appeared, ready to attack him. He slashed out with his lance, battered them with his rigid hands. But Duncan didn't fall. A student's worst enemy is his own mind. Panting, he focused his thoughts. The challenge is to control fear. I must never forget that these are not real adversaries, no matter how solid their blows feel. He had to use every skill he had learned, assemble the diverse techniques, and survive, just like a real battle. The Ganaz school could teach methods, but no two combat situations were identical. A warrior's greatest weapons are mental and physical agility, coupled with adaptability. Concentrating on the direct route across the chasm, he took one step after another. Using his spear to knock aside the unreal opponents, he reached the opposite end of the rope, sweating and exhausted, ready to drop. But he pushed on, toward the end. Through a short rocky gorge, the perfect place for an ambush, he sprinted along a planked path, pounding a steady rhythm on it with bare feet. He saw pits and trap doors. Hearing a burst of gunfire, he rolled and tumbled, then sprang back to his feet. A spear flew at him, but Duncan used his lance for leverage and vaulted over the obstacle, spinning his body in a blur. As he landed, a glimmer of motion streaked toward his face. With lightning speed, he whipped the lance staff in front of his eyes, felt two sudden sharp impacts in the wood. A pair of tiny flying mechs had embedded themselves in the shaft, like self-motivated arrowheads. He saw more blood on the deck, and another butchered body lying on the ground. Though he was not supposed to think of fallen comrades, he regretted the loss of even one talented student who had made it through so much training, only to fall there, in the last challenge. So close. Sometimes he caught glimpses of Ganaz observers beyond the crackling shield fence, keeping pace with him, other swordmasters, many of whom he remembered. Duncan didn't dare permit himself to wonder how his fellow students had fared. He didn't know if Resser was still alive. So far he had used the knives and the lance, but not the old Duke's sword, which remained at his side. It was a reassuring presence, as if Paulus Atreides accompanied him in spirit form, whispering advice along the way. "Any young man with balls as big as yours is a man I must have as part of my household," the old Duke had once told him. With the vanquished mechs behind him, blocked on both sides by the shield fence, Duncan faced the final obstacle. A huge, sunken cauldron of burning oil, a vat spanning the path, blocked on both sides by the shield fence. The end of the corridor of death. He coughed in the acrid smoke, covered his mouth and nose with his shirt fabric, but he still couldn't see. Blinking away irritated tears, he studied the buried cauldron, which looked like a hungry demon's mouth. A narrow rim encircled the vat, slippery with splatters of oil, thick with noxious vapors. The final obstacle. Duncan would have to pass it somehow. Behind him, a high metal gate shot up across his path, preventing him from returning the way he had come. It was barbed with shiga wire, unclimbable. I never intended to turn back anyway. Never argue with your instincts, boy, Paulus Atreides had counseled him. Based on a gut feeling, the old Duke had taken the young refugee into his household, despite knowing that Duncan had come from a Harkonnen world. Duncan wondered if he could possibly vault over the cauldron, but he couldn't see the far side through the shimmering flames and smoke-smeared air. What if the cauldron was not really round, but distorted, to trap a student making assumptions? Tricks within tricks. Was the vat only a hollow projection? But he felt the heat, coughed in the smoke. He threw his lance, and it clanked against the metal side. Hearing a heavy ratchet and the rumble of metal plates behind him, he turned to see the huge gate sliding toward him. If he didn't move, the barrier would push him into the cauldron. Drawing the old Duke's sword, he swished it through the air. The weapon seemed entirely useless. Think! Expect the unexpected. He studied the shield fence on his right, the shimmer of the force field, and remembered his shield training sessions on Caladan with Thufir Hawat. The slow blade penetrates the body shield, but it must move at just the right speed, not too fast and not too slow. He stroked the Duke's sword in the air for practice. Could he breach the flickering fence and tumble through? If a slow blade penetrated the shield, the energy of the barrier could be moved, changed, shifted. The sharp point of the sword could distort the field, puncture an opening. But how long would a shield remain compromised if penetrated by a sword? Could he push his body through the temporary opening before the shield closed again? Behind him, the barbed gate ground closer, nudging him toward the burning cauldron. But he would not go. Duncan visualized how he would accomplish what he had in mind. His options were limited. He stepped toward the pulsing barrier and stopped where he could smell the ozone and feel the crackle of energy on his skin. He tried to remember one of the prayers his mother had sung to him before Rabban had murdered her. But he could recall only fragments that made no sense. Gripping the old Duke's heavy sword, Duncan leaned into the shield fence and pierced it as if it were a wall of water, then dragged the blade up, feeling the ripples of the field. It reminded him of gutting a fish. Then he pushed himself forward, following the sword point, dropping through the resistance, and fell in a wave of dizziness onto a rough surface of black lava. He rolled and landed on his feet, still gripping the sword, ready to fight the swordmasters if they challenged him for breaking the rules. Suddenly he was safe from the cauldron and the moving gate.
Excellent! We have another survivor!
Frizzy-haired Jamo Reed, released from prison island duty, rushed up to embrace Duncan in a bear-like hug. Swordmaster Mord Kerr and Jay Wu weren't far behind, wearing alien expressions of delight on their faces. Duncan had never seen either of them look so pleased. Was that the only way out, he asked, trying to catch his breath as he looked at Swordmaster Kerr. The old man gave a boisterous laugh.
You found one of 22 ways, Idaho.
Another voice intruded. Do you want to go back and search for the other possibilities? It was Resser, grinning from ear to scarred ear. Duncan slipped the old Duke's sword into its scabbard and clapped his friend on the back. How to define the Kwisatz Haderach? The male who is everywhere simultaneously. The only man who can truly become the greatest human of all of us, mingling masculine and feminine ancestry with inseparable power. Bene Gesserit, Ajar Book. Beneath the imperial palace, in a network of perimeter water lanes and connected central pools, two women swam in black seal suits. The younger of the pair stroked slowly, staying back to help the older whenever she faltered. Their impermeable suits, slick as oil and warm as a womb, offered flexibility while modestly covering the chest, midriff, and upper legs. Despite the fact that some Bene Gesserit women wore common clothing, even exquisite gowns for special occasions, such as imperial balls and gala events. They were counseled to keep their bodies covered on an everyday basis. It helped to foster the mystique that kept the sisters apart.
I can't do what I used to, Reverend Mother Lobia wheezed,
as Anirul helped her into the largest of 7 central pools, a steaming water oasis, scented with salts and herbs. Not so long ago, truthsayer Lobia had been able to outswim Anirul quite easily. But now, at more than 170 years old, her health had been declining. Warm condensation dripped from the arched stone ceiling overhead, like a tropical rain.
You're doing fine, Reverend Mother.
Anirul held the ancient woman's arm and helped her up a stone stairway.
Don't ever lie to a truthsayer, Lobia said with a wrinkled smile.
Her yellowing eyes danced, but she was gasping for air.
Especially not the Emperor's truthsayer.
Surely the Emperor's wife deserves a bit of leniency. The old woman chuckled. Anirul helped her into a flow-form chair, handed her a plush Carthan weave towel. Lobia lay back with the towel over her and pressed a button to activate the chair's skin massage. She sighed as the electric fields pulsed her muscles and nerve endings.
Preparations have been made for my replacement, Lobia said in a sleepy voice, over the hum of the chair. I've seen the names of the candidates. It will be good to go back to the mother school, though I doubt I will ever see it again. On Kaitain the climate is so perfect, but I long for the cold and the damp of Wallach 9. Odd, don't you think?
Anirul perched on the edge of her chair, seeing the age on the truthsayer's face, heard the ever-present murmur of crowded lives within herself. As the secret Kwisatz mother, Anirul lived with a clear and strident presence of other memory inside her head. All the lives down the long path of her heritage spoke in her, telling her things that even most Bene Gesserit did not know. Lobia, with all her years, didn't know as much about age as Anirul.
I am wise beyond my years.
This was not hubris. It was more a sensation of the weight of history and events that she bore with her.
What will the Emperor do without you around, Reverend Mother?